Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. My guest is Violet Ramis Steele, who's out with a new book, Ghostbusters' Daughter, Life with My Dad, Harold Ramis. The book is available from Blue Rider Press. Harold Ramis, of course, was the very talented actor, writer, and director who co-wrote Animal House, Stripes, Ghostbusters, among many, many other films and comedy ventures. Violet, you had a front row seat to your father's career. What was the earliest point you remember when you realized just how big a juggernaut your father was in the entertainment industry?
I don't think I realized that really until after he passed away. I knew that he had a big impact on comedy and film at the time, but I didn't realize, I guess, how far his reach extended and how many people really loved and admired and, you know, could sort of endlessly quote his work.
I was surprised, or not surprised, but I was interested to read how hard of a worker your dad was before he got into entertainment. And you said one thing he told you was to never work in retail. He's raised in Chicago, went to college in St. Louis, but he always worked, including a job at a mental institution. How much did those early years as a hard worker shape his career and then what he in turn gave to you?
I think they've shaped them a lot. I mean, he grew up in sort of a working class family in Chicago. He would say middle class on a good day. He was bagging groceries from the time he was a kid. So I think there was no question that he, you know, could really buckle down and do what needed to be done. I think with his children, you know, particularly myself, the work ethic wasn't so important. It was more like, do what you need to do, follow through on any commitments you make, but, you know, don't forget to have a good time.
Well, take me back, and I know this predates your existence, but he got into Second City in Chicago and then eventually into SCTV. It was really by accident that he got into Second City, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was really just sort of in the right place at the right time with the right group of people. And he did start out in Second City in Chicago. I think the first time he auditioned, you know, for one of their companies, he was rejected. So he sort of took himself down the street to the Old Town Theater and started teaching improv there for a little while, and then eventually made it back to Second City, which led to the National Lampoon Radio Hour and SCTV and Animal House, and, you know, the rest is history.
If you didn't know your father's job, what he did for a living, would you have considered him, just from your own personal interactions, a funny person?
Yes. I mean, he was very funny. He was very animated. He liked to, you know, play his guitar and sing funny songs, and, you know, nothing makes people love you more than making them laugh, and he was great at that.
Well, and funny people a lot of times get into the business because it's their life, but did that seem to affect him, that he was funny in normal life, but then that was also his job?
No, I mean, I think that's, you know, where the don't go into retail advice comes in, is that he really loved what he did, and he was happy to do it. I mean, I think, you know, he struggled like anybody and had moments of writer's block and being exhausted and, you know, not wanting to do what he needed to do, but he always, you know, sort of found a way to make it work and, you know, kept finding that inspiration in everything he did.
This book is full of all kinds of little tidbits. Like, I didn't know Stripes was originally written for Cheech and Chong. And I didn't know that you played Daisy Mabel, the girl without a tongue, in National Lampoon's Vacation.
I certainly did.
I remember watching that with my brother and sister, and we noticed that you had your tongue out in the scene before the actor said that she was born without a tongue.
Darn it.
Yeah. How did that come about that you got that role?
I mean, when I was a kid, I was, you know, very interested in movies and actors and actresses, and I wanted my big shot, so I kept, you know, sort of pestering him to put me in something, and, you know, this was his way of doing it, but not letting me talk.
But you hung out with all these actors on the set, and was their interaction with you, was it positive? I mean, did they treat you like a kid?
I mean, they did, but they were all really interesting, funny, warm people. I mean, I was with my dad all the time when I was a kid. He took me with him sort of everywhere he went, and it made life seem like a great adventure, and everyone was really so nice and generous. I mean, you know, I was born in Toronto when they were making Second SCTV, you know, so Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin and Catherine O'Hara, you know, were around me so much as a baby. And then later, obviously, it was Bill Murray and Chevy Chase and Rodney Dangerfield. I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of a comedy circus in a way.
Well, your dad co-wrote Ghostbusters with Dan Aykroyd, and he also played Peter Venkman in it. But during the filming, I know you said you lived in New York at a New York City hotel with him, but I think you said later that you were too young to appreciate the greatness of that movie. So take me back to when you first saw the movie, saw it filming, what you thought of it versus as you watched it as an early teenager.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I was a little bit blasé as a kid, I guess. I needed, you know, something to rebel against. So everyone was going crazy for Ghostbusters. I was in, I think, third grade at the time. And, you know, my friends would all gather around him when he would come to pick me up from school, Egon. And so I was like, oh, God, Ghostbusters just isn't that funny, everybody. but, you know, later I was able to get some distance from it and really appreciate all of the things that, you know, maybe it was just going over my head as a kid, but I definitely grew to love it later in life.
When you're in New York City in the early 80s, during the Ghostbusters filming, what was the city like then compared to when people visit it now?
I mean, I was a kid, so my experience was limited, but it was definitely much sort of grittier at the time, you know, a little more of an edge. Now, like so many places, you know, it's a little more, it's definitely safer, but, you know, also sort of more Disney-fied in a way, and you don't have to worry when you walk around about getting mugged as much, but, you know, there just isn't necessarily the same sort of rock and roll energy that there was.
We're talking with Violet Ramis Steele, the author of the brand new book, Ghostbusters' Daughter, Life with My Dad, Harold Ramis. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Blue Rider Press. Violet, Groundhog Day is probably one of the most widely loved films of your dad's career. And I kind of disagree with that. I think so many of them could be up in that slot. But nonetheless, that's where all these lists shake out. But he took a lot of pride that the film was so well respected by religious and spiritual leaders of all stripes. Why was that particular vote of confidence so important to him?
I think, you know, he was very interested in big ideas, you know, sort of psychology, philosophy, spirituality, history. And so Groundhog Day, you know, meant a lot to him because it was really embraced by all these various points of view. You know, Buddhists thought it was a Buddhist movie, Jewish people thought it was a Jewish movie, Christians thought it was a Christian movie. And so I think that, you know, that really speaks to sort of his universal appeal and relatability, that he could take these, you know, sort of heavy themes and bring them down to earth.
My cousin lived in Woodstock, Illinois at the time that movie was filmed, and every time I would talk to him, he would talk up about how great it was and having that film there. I thought he was sort of a lone ranger in that, but as I read your book, your father, I mean, if they had a Mount Rushmore in Woodstock, Illinois, your father's face would be the only one on it, right?
Yeah, I mean, they have a Harold Ramis Auditorium Theater, which I'll be, you know, actually visiting this weekend to speak and sign some books. I mean, yeah, the town really embraced the whole movie and him, and I think, you know, that sort of small town magic that Woodstock provided really added such an authentic dimension to the film.
I know that he was a Chicago guy, but did he have any connection with the town before the filming there?
No, none at all.
And, you know, that film also led to the breakup of his relationship and friendship with Bill Murray. How did your dad handle that type of loss of a friend in that way?
I mean, he really, you know, was very zen about everything. I mean, he took it in stride. He, you know, it was always sort of a great mystery to him of exactly what happened, but you know, he really never had a bad word to say and was just happy that they had created all this wonderful work together that would live on, you know, no matter what.
Was your dad happiest when he was writing or directing, or did it really matter?
I think he loved it all. I mean, he really liked working, you know, collaboratively with other people. So he did like being on set as sort of the captain of the ship. But he also liked, you know, writing with his friends, you know, especially Doug Kenny and Brian Doyle Murray, Peter Tolan. I mean, they had a lot of fun writing all their scripts together. And, you know, I think he really just, like I said, loved what he did, and that included all parts of the process.
Did he have to protect you from watching some of his work? Because, you know, at your young age, Animal House isn't an appropriate movie, but very funny as you get older. Was that ever a factor?
No. for better or worse, you know, appropriate was not a word that we used a lot when I was a kid. So, My parents just kind of exposed me to everything, and, you know, then we'd talk about it and figure it out, and I could decide if I, you know, wanted to participate or not. You know, I think I fell asleep, I'm sure, in Animal House when I first saw it. Those jokes went over my head, but no, they were not trying to protect me from anything.
And it's kind of funny with a classic like Animal House. I watch it now and still laugh, and I've seen it, you know, 5-6 dozen times, but you point out in the book that if that movie had been made today and you have a 15-year-old getting essentially molested at a frat party, that would never happen today in a made movie, right?
No, I don't think it would have been made in that way today. And I don't, you know, I mean, yes, it all seemed so funny then, but, you know, are those really the things we want to be laughing at? I mean, I think, you know, certain elements just don't age as well, and I don't think that takes away from the movies as a whole. I think they're still classics that we can enjoy and look back on, but I think it's also important to have a critical eye when looking at, you know, at what we consume.
In addition to your father's story, this story is also your story as well. You tell several stories from your childhood: molestation by a mother's boyfriend, pregnancy, ill-advised relationships, and you ran the gamut as a kid between hippie, goth, artsy. How therapeutic was it for you to get these stories out in the public?
I mean, it was, but not so much for myself. I mean, these are things that I've already dealt with in my own actual therapy, so those were just things that happened. I mean, we were all sort of doing the best we could, and that was, you know, such an important lesson that my dad taught me was, you know, you don't have to judge it. Things happen, you deal with them, you do your best, and, you know, then you move on. And he was able to do that in his life, and I think that I've been able to do that in mine.
I love that in the book you reprinted the commencement addresses that your dad gave at both your high school and college graduations, and they're very funny, and I like the line where he said that, you know, if you remember one thing from the speech, remember that it's the greatest speech you ever heard and changed your life. But did he embrace being the celebrity parent of your class?
He did. I mean, and I think he embraced those things independently and together. I mean, he was a great teacher. He had a lot to say. He was very thoughtful. He, you know, wanted to be a force for good in the world. And so, you know, he was fatherly, and everyone sort of responded to that and was drawn to him. And he was great at it.
You recount in the story your own 9/11 story. You were in New York City just starting a new job that day, and your dad was going to fly out of town. Can you take me back to that morning and the emotions you went through when you thought that you would have an immediate family connection to that tragedy?
Yeah, I mean, he and my stepmother, Erica, were scheduled to fly out of LaGuardia, I believe, that morning, and I was, you know, teaching preschool at the time, and it was the first day of school, so, you know, initially nobody knew what was going on, and we sort of thought, oh, maybe it's just, you know, someone flying a small plane and had an accident. But once we knew, you know, I immediately thought, you know, where did the planes come from? What planes were they? Is my dad okay? And, you know, finding out that he was a huge relief, but, you know, also it wasn't about me. I mean, it was something that really definitely changed the city and the country and, you know, maybe even the world.
I don't think any of us realized how sick your dad was during his final years, and you discuss it very frankly in the book. I mean, wheelchair, couldn't talk, couldn't walk at some points, and how disheartening was that at the time for your family as well as your father?
It was really difficult. I mean, he, I think, had, you know, such a charmed life in a way up to that point. You know, he wrote in a letter to me and my brothers and sister, you know, I used to feel like the luckiest guy in the world, but now I'm not so sure. It was very hard to watch him struggle and sort of get farther and farther away. But, you know, we were all together. We were there for him as much as we all could be. And, you know, we really stayed close and present until the end.
Well, it's just a remarkable story about a remarkable man, and you had a front row seat to all of it, and I know that you're incredibly proud of your father, and I know he was of you. The book is Ghostbusters' Daughter, Life with My Dad, Harold Ramis, by Violet Ramis Steele. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold from Blue Rider Press. Violet, just a fantastic book. It took me through so many memories of my own childhood because I was growing up about the same time you were. Thanks for sharing your story, and thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. There's something strange in your neighborhood.